targeting undocumented immigrants, but TSA is this thing where they classify everything as sensitive security information. It's like their own invented classification. So they couldn't release anything. In the GAO reports, you just see like redacted, redacted, TSA would not supply the documents. People have long been saying that this is what's happening. We just now have numbers to show that here it is. Where are your terrorists?
Well, Jonna Winter, we want to thank you very much for being with us. A reporter with The Intercept, her latest piece is headlined TSA Behavior Detection Program Targeting Undocumented Immigrants, Not Terrorists. And we'll link to it at democracynow.org. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, Sam Riddell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Prude, Vesta Gadarz, and our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Pridmeadows, and Jose Miranda. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate for another edition of Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday evening news coming up. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America Oregon, presenting a symposium on diversity, equity, and economic sustainability, May 8th at the Shilas Center. Keynote speaker, Stedman Graham. Tickets and information at volunteersofamerica.org.
KBOO and the Quinta Street Theater are proud to present a music documentary that raises the bar for the genre. Arrows into Infinity, the new documentary about the life of jazz musician Charles Lloyd. Thursday, April 9 at the Clinton Street Theater. Arrows into Infinity takes us on Lloyd's journey from the heights of jazz rock royalty to his life in seclusion and back again. Arrows into Infinity, the Portland premiere. Thursday, April 9, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland. Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight, hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's Planning and Sustainability Commission holds a public hearing on the proposed Pembina pipeline.
Oregon State Senate approves bill limiting suspension of young students.
And teens are suing the state of Oregon for insufficient action against climate change.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 7th, 2015. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Oregon State Police have released the name of a man who was shot at by a Linn County deputy on Monday evening. According to a police spokesman, officers were waiting to assist an ambulance crew when 68-year-old James Lindsay pointed a rifle at them. During the ensuing confrontation, one of the deputies fired his gun at Lindsay but missed. Lindsay is currently being held at the Linn County Jail on accusations of fourth-degree assault. The Oregon State Police has not released the name of the deputy who shot at Mr. Lindsay, but says they will do so after internal investigators finish interviewing him.
A police officer in South Carolina has been arrested and charged with murder after he shot a man during a traffic stop over the weekend. The shooting happened this past Saturday after a traffic stop. Michael Slager had pulled over Walter Scott, who tried to run away. Scott had outstanding warrants. After a brief chase, Scott was shot seven times in the back. Video taken by an anonymous bystander shows the officer yelling to Scott to put your hands behind your back. He then proceeded to put on the handcuffs. Scott died on the scene. The video was given to Scott's family and to the police department. The mayor of North Charleston says that as a result of the video and the bad decision made by the officer, he will be charged with murder.
A report from the Violence Policy Center has found that in 17 states, you are more likely to die from guns than car crashes. In 2013, gun deaths, including gun suicide, homicide, and fatal unintentional shootings, outpaced motor vehicle deaths in Alaska, Arizona, Colorado, District of Columbia, Indiana, Louisiana, Maryland, Michigan, Missouri, Nevada, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Utah, Virginia, Washington, and Wyoming. The states with the most gun deaths were Alaska, Louisiana, Wyoming, Tennessee, and Missouri, where the death rate was at least 50% higher than the national average of 10.64 gun deaths per 100,000 people. The report contrasts how car makers have taken steps to prevent injury and death, while gun makers and gun lobbyists have fought off many sensible safety regulations. Firearms remain the last consumer product manufactured in the United States not subject to federal health and safety regulation, whereas cars have been subject to safety requirements for decades with things like seat belts and headrests.
The Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission is currently holding a public hearing on whether to allow the Pembina Propane Company to construct a pipeline at the Port of Portland. The hearing began at 3 p.m. and is scheduled to continue until 8 p.m., Tonight's vote will determine whether to change the zoning of the area in order to allow Pembina to construct a pipeline along a strip of public land in northwest Portland that is currently zoned for conservation. The pipeline would transport liquid propane a short distance from a train yard to the port, where it would be loaded onto ships for export. The company was allowed to write its own risk analysis of the site and concluded that there would be little to no risk. Here's a clip from a January meeting in which the Pembina representative described their findings.
In the last 2 years, as Pembina has reviewed other potential marine sites on the west coast of North America, preliminary modeling for those other sites with similar ships and equipment indicated a hazard and consequence zone of approximately 300 yards. That information is not specific to the Portland Terminal 6 site, and our retained experts are currently performing a technical detailed model specific for this site. Safety is number one for Pembina and will always be.
So just real quick, make sure I heard you. You're saying a radius of 300 yards?
For the sites, for the other model sites that we did across North or on the West Coast, it's not specific to this site, but it gives us an indication of about 300 yards.
But local community activists and researchers have challenged the company's analysis and instead came up with their own risk analysis. The local study addressed issues that the Pembina study did not, including the potential impact of earthquakes, terrorism, or train crashes of the propane tank cars used to transport the flammable liquid propane. Bob Salinger of the Portland Audubon Society spoke at a rally in January opposing the terminal and the pipeline.
We've been concerned about this for quite some time, and we've been waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it has dropped. So let's talk about what the facility that they are proposing would do. It would increase Portland's climate emissions, carbon emissions, by 0.7%. Wow. The amount of electricity that this facility would require would generate almost a full percentage of Portland's climate emissions. That's an astounding number. And when I saw that, because it came from the City of Portland in its analysis, I asked the City of Portland, are you sure about that? Because it's hard to find things that actually are measurable at that scale. And they said yes, and then I asked Pembina, and they said yes, they were contesting that. But even more amazing is the City of Portland's analysis that this will increase global climate emissions by 0.01%. And again, I asked the City of Portland, are you sure about that? And they said yes. And I asked Pembina, and they said, yeah, they're not contesting it. So this is a facility whose CO2 emissions are measurable not only at a local scale, but at a global scale. And this in a city that recently won a presidential award for its climate change initiatives, that has committed to reducing its carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, that prides itself on its efforts to address global climate change. And I want to read you a quote from Mayor Charlie Hales when they recently won the President's Global Climate Change Award. What does it mean for Portland? It means that the pressure is on us to work harder and to think smarter and to demand more of ourselves. So who here believes that this Pembina facility is smarter, working harder, or demanding more of ourselves? No, it's a total cop-out. And so we're going to be faced with the spectacle of the City of Portland asking people to ride bicycles and plant trees and put eco-roofs on their buildings. And we should be asking that, and we should be asking a lot more at the same time that the City of Portland is potentially going to approve a facility that will facilitate the export of between 552 and 828 million gallons of propane every year. And it gets worse than that, because the city's analysis, this has been fast-tracked. Who here was involved in the public process to approve this facility? Nobody. Who here thinks there was a public process for this facility? Unfortunately, this city has responded to industry demands and our working waterfront to reduce public process, to approve things in advance, to basically reduce the public oversight that we have on industrial lands. And this is a case in point, because but for the fact that they require an amendment to the environmental zone to allow the pipeline to go through, there would be no public process. Now, Pembina has been quoted in the paper saying they want to take their time, allow the people of Portland to get their heads around this, and if we don't want them, they won't come. Well, do we want them?
No!
Despite the community opposition, the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission appears to be leaning toward approving the zone change. A city consultant found Pembina's report, which minimized the risk, to be a, quote, thorough and realistic evaluation of the potential risks and consequences, unquote, of the preserved terminal, of the proposed terminal. KBOO's own Chris Andre, who was at the hearing in downtown Portland now, joins us live. Chris, what is the atmosphere there at the public hearing?
People are very intense. Obviously there's a lot of joyful intensity, but everybody here realizes exactly what's at stake. And even though obviously it's a predominantly white crowd, I think that everybody clearly understands that this is a First Nations issue and yet another crime that is being perpetrated against Indigenous people. In a long, long series that has unfolded as the river flows.
Yeah.
So
and go ahead.
Our guest right now is joining us for a moment before we go back in, John Thomas. He will talk a little bit about some of the issues that are particularly concerned.
Great. Wonderful. I'm sorry. And what was your name again? Who were we speaking with once more?
Yeah, this is John Talbert. I'm president and senior economist for Center for Sustainable Economy.
John Talbert, thank you so much for joining us. What brought you to the hearing and kind of what is the focus here?
Well, our organization, CSE, is deeply involved in this issue because we think a land use change that would accommodate not only Pembina, but many other exporters that will be attracted to this area if the Pembina decision goes through, is fundamentally inconsistent with Portland's vision of economic development that has been meticulously put together over the last decade through numerous citizen-led processes, such as the Portland Plan, the Comprehensive Land Use Plan, the Estuaries, Columbia River Estuaries Restoration Plan. All these call for economic development that is local, sustainable, that nurtures local businesses and uses our scarce Portlands to to promote the export of sustainable products from local businesses, not the exports of fossil fuels from a foreign company. So we think it's fundamentally inconsistent with economic development. We're very concerned legally about this issue from a land use perspective. If the Portland Sustainability Commission approves this land use change, it would have done it in a very sloppy fashion that ignores the economic cost the city will face as a result, and is would be based on analysis that is 90% incomplete at this point. So we have a lot of issues with not only this facility, but what it represents for Portland's future.
Full. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us, John Talbert. We really appreciate it. We're going to move on to our next article, but thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
And for more information, where may we find more information from you, John?
Nonetheless.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us for the live report from the public hearing.
The Port of Portland. The Port of Portland has lost yet another major container shipping company. Hapag-Lloyd is reportedly the fourth largest container shipper in the world. It had been the largest company still using the Port of Portland following the withdrawal of the Hanjin Shipping Company in February. Hapag-Lloyd had accounted for 20% of the Port of Portland's shipping business prior to Hanjin's pullout. The last Hapag-Lloyd ship to use Portland was the MV Seaspan Dalian, which set sail on March 28th. The Oregonian reports that the only remaining shipping line using Portland's port operation is a smaller carrier called Westwood. The nearest remaining major ports for Portland companies either shipping or receiving goods are the Port of Seattle to the north and the Port of Oakland to the south.
The Portland Public Schools Board of Education has agreed to hear a Title IX complaint from the mother of a Wilson High School student. According to the Willamette Weekly, the complaint revolves around the unequal scheduling of basketball games. The current schedule places more boys' games in primetime slots, while girls play earlier in the day. This means girls miss more class time than boys in order to travel to their games. Allison Horn brought the case on behalf of her daughter and other students. She argues that the PPS basketball schedule violates Title IX, which bans gender discrimination. The school board will hear the complaint on April 20th and vote on April 28th.
The Oregon State Senate has approved a bill that prohibits elementary schools from expelling or suspending students for minor disruptions. Supporters say it will help curb racial bias in public schools. The bill outlines specific situations under which a student can be kicked out. Elementary schools can only remove a student if they intentionally cause serious physical harm to another person or if an administrator decides that they directly threaten the safety of others. According to the nonprofit law firm Youths, Rights, and Justice, 8,000 elementary school students were kicked out last year. 71% of those students were disciplined under the vague category of disruptive behavior. Studies show that students who are suspended while they're young are much more likely to be incarcerated or drop out of school later. Here's some of the testimony given at a meeting of the Senate Education Committee, beginning with State Senator Sarah Gelser, who sponsored the bill.
There are significant disparities when it comes to out-of-school suspension. Students of color are more likely than white children to be suspended from school. Students with disabilities are more likely than students without disabilities. So this is something that also directly impacts our graduation rates and is an issue that we're going to need to address if we want to meet our 40-40-20 goals.
My name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We are a nonprofit law firm in Multnomah County, and we've represented about 50,000 children and youth since 1975 and in the juvenile court system, and have focused on their educational needs in particular for nearly 20 years. As Senator Gelser mentioned, Senate Bill 553 would prevent schools from kicking students out of school if they're under the age of 12. So we're basically talking about fifth grade and younger elementary school students. For a bit of context, there have been a huge explosion in suspension and expulsion nationwide since the 1970s, and that was further exacerbated with zero tolerance policies that swept through criminal justice and juvenile justice and eventually the schools in the 1990s. In the 2009-10 school year, Oregon K through five schools suspended over 6,000 students, 6,220. By the 2011-12 school year, it was up to 8,600 K through five students, a 38% increase in just two school years. Fortunately, since then, we've seen a slight decline. In the most recent school year, there were 7,977 K through five students suspended or expelled in Oregon. And it's important to know, and this has been the focus of school discipline reform here and nationwide, is that most students are not kicked out for serious offenses. According to the state data, 71% of the students in elementary who were suspended in 2013-2014 school year were for what's categorized as disruptive behavior. So not being on task, not being prepared, not immediately following teacher directions, but otherwise not causing harm to the school. But the harm comes often in the exclusion of the students, and it takes them out of the educational environment, causes them to be behind academically, which paradoxically is likely to lead to more serious behavior problems in the future. And there have been some more recent studies done on how exclusion actually affects all the students in the school. And a couple of studies that have been done so far show a detrimental effect school-wide when exclusionary discipline is used frequently, that the academic success of all the students in a school with high rates of suspension and expulsion suffer. And that's important to note because often the rationale for removing arguably a problem student from a classroom was to benefit all the other students in the class, but the research is finding that sort of common sense is actually not true in many cases.
The bill passed by a vote of 27-3 and now moves to the House.
Two teens are suing the state of Oregon for insufficient action against the threat of climate change. Young adults Kelsey Juliana and Olivia Chernek of Eugene originally filed suit in 2011, claiming Oregon's failure to comply with climate change legislation. House Bill 3543, passed in 2007, pledged a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions down to 75% of the levels in 1990 by the year 2050. According to Julian and Chernek, the state's sluggish progress towards the fruition of this pledge violates the public trust doctrine, a legal principle requiring that certain resources be preserved for public use and maintained by the government to that end. The public trust doctrine protects Oregon's waterways and submerged lands. However, the teen's lawyer argues that air is also an important public resource that demands a similar level of protection for future generations. The teen's suit was filed with help from Our Children's Trust, an Oregon-based nonprofit that supports the legal rights of youth and future generations to a healthy planet. The NPO has been involved in a number of cases like this, though today's hearing is the first to garner this much attention.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today I have with me Don Wadle, who has been doing some quite extraordinary work around native law. I'd like him to introduce himself.
My name is Don Wadle. I've worked for about 35, 40 years with tribal governments on various issues, but 35 years mostly in Minnesota on tribal laws and regulations dealing with particularly natural resource kinds of things. I've also worked with Native Alaska villages in Western Alaska on various environmental and governmental structures that they're trying to implement and develop, and a little bit of work with some Canadian government, tribal governments. So
tell me a bit about the significance of what I'm guessing is the kind of growth into more visibility and significance for non-native legal structures, that non-native legal structures are probably having to pay more and more attention to native legal structures these days. And I'm just wondering, give me some anecdotes or some stories about the kind of native legal structures that you're working on in native communities.
In the particular tribe, I worked with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe in central Minnesota. In the early 80s, we developed what was called separation powers form of government and changed the governmental structure and developed a codified tribal law. And developed one of the things many tribal governments have difficulty with is that it's very easy within the tribal system to have a mechanism so that no one knows who's really responsible for some particular issue. As a result, a lot of times it becomes difficult to resolve issues because no one's really responsible for the issue. And that was something we saw in the tribal government and implemented into tribal law authorities for various people. And that authority came in the form of commissioners. And so the tribe had set up commissioners of natural resource, commissioner of education, commissioner of human development. And these commissioners then, under law, had specific duties and responsibilities. And they also had authority to implement regulations and requirements that were necessary for fulfilling those responsibilities. And as Commissioner of Natural Resources, I had a wide range of responsibilities for regulating hunting, jurisdiction over land use, land exchanges, land acquisition, all of those types of things. And as a result, implemented many, many commissioners' orders because the codification of tribal law was relatively new. There wasn't many orders, and there was lots of things that could be regulated and needed to be regulated. One example was I issued an order that said the only land that a tribe would give up would be for other lands that was equal and same in value as the ones given up. So there was always an effort to try to access tribal lands by state governments, county governments, corporations, and there was, by issuing the order, the only way this could be done was through giving up or acquiring some other land with equal value. And that was very helpful in many cases.
So I'm guessing that there's pretty significant differences between native government regulating land hunting fishing and non-native government regulating land hunting fishing.
Right.
Can you kind of peel that apart?
Sure. In our process, we had a tier of uses for natural resources or exchanges. Tribal efforts to regulate hunting and fishing, I always said that our management system was trying not to manage. We put more effort in trying not to develop management systems than into actually developing management systems. The priority for tribal access to resources was that if there was a limited resource, then that only went for cultural and spiritual uses first. If that consumed all of the available resource, then it was stopped there. The second level was then for subsistence existence of these resources. And finally, if there were things that was more than what was needed for both ceremonial and subsistence, then there could be some commercialization of that depending on a lot of different factors. And so that was the hierarchy of how the tribe looked at use of resources and how it promoted regulations around those.
And you're using this commodification framework too, which must be also somewhat challenging, that natural resources really are the commodification of nature.
Right. And one of the things that was extremely difficult was in discussing with the elders the use of resources and you know, in the traditional American sense, there was always this idea that, well, we'll manage the resource and then we'll have a harvestable surplus that's available to sell licensing to. People can go out and we can exploit this resource, and as a result, this gets us revenue and control of the resource and all these types of things. And when tribal elders would always say, well, only take what you need. And for me, initially, I couldn't grasp that concept about what does it mean, take what you need, because that seems to open the door to taking everything if you decide you need it. And
who gets to define need?
Right, and who gets to define it? And one of the things that eventually became more clear to me was that the need is that we have exchanges going on between the natural world and the human world, and you can't keep those exchanges if you don't do the exchange.
Right, because we're not used to seeing these as reciprocal relationships.
Right. Right.
Well, we could go on, I'm sure, for a bunch of more minutes, but I'm out of time. Thank you very much, Don. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News and a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at cnfuegospaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcnfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a KBOO in-depth report on a book about the hidden history of Israel that has raised a bit of controversy. Followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight, we're excited to talk with some organizers of this year's Local Queer Students of Color Conference, taking place on April 18th and 19th. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight, there is a 50% chance it will rain and a 50% chance it won't. Low temperatures around 45. Tomorrow, a chance of showers after 11 a.m. Partly sunny with a high near 62. Today is the birthday of Billie Holiday. She would have been 100 years old. And she says they think they can make fuel from horse manure. Now, I don't know if your car will be able to get 30 miles to the gallon, but it's sure gonna put a stop to siphoning. That's Billie Holiday.
It's 5:32. Time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's futile to hope that the GOP's gaggle of corporate-hugging right-wing presidential candidates will seriously address the issue of rising inequality in our land. But where are the Democrats? Well, Hillary Clinton has warned that, quote, extreme inequality has corrupted other societies. Yes, but what about our society? Clinton says, quote, we have to have a concerted effort to meet a consensus about how to deal with this. Huh? That's not an answer, much less a solution. It's a political tap dance around a crucial matter facing America. Why would she dodge a chance to swing away at a down-the-middle working-class issue that's right in the wheelhouse of her party's populist strength? After all, recent polls show huge public support for direct government action to reduce the wealth gap, from raising taxes on the super-rich to raising the minimum wage above the poverty level. But there is one tiny constituency whose opinion outweighs all others on this issue, the one percenters. Clinton and other top Democrats are weaker than Canadian hot sauce when it comes to embracing the unequivocating populism that ordinary voters want, because only 13% of the super-rich think government should take action to redress inequality. These privileged ones tend to blame America's widening inequities on the very people who are losing jobs, income, and wealth, claiming that such people should simply improve their work ethic and character. Why would Democrats care what these few supercilious elites think? Well, because meek Democrats like Clinton have become so dependent on rich people's campaign checks that they let them restrict the party's policies and message, thus alienating the workaday majority. This is Jim Hightower saying, when both parties kowtow to money, the people's needs are ignored and politics becomes illegitimate.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Southern trees bear strange.
An alarming report identifying six major trends in the criminalization of poverty in America over the last 50 years was released this past month. Author Karen Dolan provides a succinct yet detailed piece exploring the policies and causes leading to an overrepresentation of the poor, particularly those of color, in prison institutions. Dolan divides her research into six sections, each addressing a key element in the discussion of the criminalization of poverty. They include the rise of debtors' prisons from poor people saddled with fines and fees for misdemeanors, the barrier to employment and public services for individuals with a conviction or arrest on file, the school-to-prison pipelines born from excessive punishment of poor school children, the arrest of homeless people and sympathizers, and civil asset forfeiture, the confiscation of the limited resources and property of impoverished individuals. Dolan's report received notable endorsement from Barbara Ehrenreich, the New York Times best-selling author of Nickel and Dimed. Ehrenreich wrote the report's foreword and was later quoted at the conclusion of Dolan's introduction with a profoundly fitting quote, "When you leave the relative safety of the middle class, you might as well have given up your citizenship and taken residence in a hostile nation."
Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here's a fruit for the crows to pluck.
Energy companies in California are under fire after using nearly 70 million gallons of water for fracking last year. The report comes days after Governor Jerry Brown issued an executive order to reduce water use by 25% over the next year. But the order doesn't apply to energy companies who use water for fracking. California's oil and gas supervisor argued that fracking does not use very much water, only 514 households worth. But as Patrick Sullivan from the Center for Biological Diversity points out, that doesn't tell the whole story. When chemicals are blasted into layers of rock, the wastewater becomes too toxic for households to reuse. Energy companies have also avoided giving out information about which chemicals they use. And despite studies linking fracking to environmental and health risks, oil and gas companies insist that fracking is perfectly safe. As the rest of California adjusts to life with less water, energy companies continue to use as much as they want. As Zach Mallett from Credo Action told Reuters, fracking and toxic injection wells may not be the largest uses of water in California, but they are undoubtedly some of the stupidest.
A power outage in Washington, D.C. left the White House, the Capitol, and the State Department buildings without power. The outage was caused by an explosion at a power station that was triggered by a downed power line. The White House lights dimmed briefly as the backup generators kicked in. Others were not so lucky. The Smithsonian, the National Portrait Gallery, and the Air and Space Museum were all evacuated. When the lights went out, Oprah Winfrey was giving a speech in D.C. to commemorate the U.S. Postal Service unveiling a new Dr. Maya Angelou Forever stamp. While the room remained dark and the microphone lost audio, Winfrey kept going to the delight of the audience. About 28,000 customers were affected.
For the average homeowner, there's more benefit to going solar than ever before. So says MappedWell, a startup company spun off from MIT that can map the solar potential of your home. Generating your own power from solar panels is a good way to insulate you from occasional grid outages, and it can go a long way towards reducing that monthly electricity bill. Solar panels pay themselves off faster than ever, and utility companies will even pay you for the excess electricity you generate. Now, you can calculate just how much your new solar installation should cost and what the payback period should be. Solar panels produce electricity even when it's cloudy in Oregon, so they may still be economically feasible for your application. For now, you can find your house if you live in Boston, Cambridge, Wellfleet in Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., and in Washington County, Oregon.
Cultural, religious, and social norms are at the root of the various kinds of abuse experienced by women human rights defenders. A new report from Amnesty International discusses the issue of women's subordinate legal, social, and political position in Afghan society, and the failure of the government to meet its obligations to ensure gender equality and address discriminatory social attitudes. The report, titled Their Lives on the Line, highlights 9 case studies to illustrate the range of violence women human rights defenders are confronted with on a daily basis, from threats, harassment, and intimidation to physical attacks on their family members and property and unlawful killings. Amnesty found that while the Taliban and other armed opposition groups are responsible for the majority of human rights abuses against women human rights defenders, they are not the only perpetrators. Government officials and powerful commanders and warlords who are supported by local authorities have also been implicated. A full copy of the report, as well as an executive summary, can be downloaded from the Amnesty International website, which is at amnesty.org.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, April 7th, 2015. Israeli settlers detain Palestinian school children and soldiers in the West Bank communities and kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A group of extremist Israelis held on Monday at night a Palestinian school bus for several hours near the Yitzhar illegal colony built on Palestinian lands southwest of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Head of the Military District Coordination Office in Nablus, Osama Mansour, said that the fanatics attacked the Palestinian bus carrying children back home after a day trip in the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The children are from the Silwad Elementary School in Silwad town in the central West Bank district of Ramallah. Mansour said the fanatics held the children from 7 in the evening until 11 at night. He added that the fanatics asked the soldiers to stop the bus allegedly after a child threw trash from his window and that the Israelis confiscated the ID card of the bus driver, his keys, and the teacher's ID cards. The Israeli fanatics then forced all the children out of the bus and held them for approximately 4 hours, demanding the child who allegedly threw the trash to surrender. The detained Palestinians were released at 11 before midnight. Also late on Monday night, Israeli soldiers attacked and injured a Palestinian man in Yatta town near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Media sources said that soldiers assaulted Muhammad Kattouf in his 40s from Yatta town south of Hebron and constantly beat him, causing various cuts and bruises. Local medics moved the wounded man to Hebron Governmental Hospital for treatment. The soldiers were heavily deployed around Yatta and installed roadblocks in the area, in addition to installing roadblocks in different parts of the Hebron district. In addition, soldiers kidnapped a Palestinian child in the old city of Hebron, while dozens of extremist Israelis stormed it, heading to the Ibrahimi Mosque. Moreover, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Tuesday at dawn 3 Palestinian children in Husan town, west of Bethlehem, and 2 children in Al Arub refugee camp, north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Soldiers also invaded a number of neighborhoods in Hebron City and installed roadblocks on the main entrance of Bani Nu'aym, Ithna, Sa'ir, Halhul, Beit Awa, and As-Samu' towns, stopped and searched dozens of cars and investigated the ID cards of the passengers. In northern West Bank district of Jenin, soldiers invaded Taiba village and searched a number of homes there. No arrests were made. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, April 7th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Maui and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news story at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Alan Monticello, Nicole Weinstock, Doug McVeigh, Jim Thompson, and Cliff Verla, with special thanks to Chris Andre. Our engineer is Sequoina Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Here's what's coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. From 7 to 8, it's Democracy Now!, a news magazine hosted by award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Roland delivers news and commentary on local, national, and international issues and invites your calls. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Jenka Soderberg looks at the case of Tristan Anderson, who was severely disabled when he was shot by a tear gas canister at a nonviolent protest against the Israeli wall. She speaks with Tristan's partner, Gabby Silverman, for an update on the lawsuit. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary hosted by Chris Andre. Stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Dirt Bag. On tomorrow's show, Don Smallman, curator of the Portland Eco Film Festival, talks about the gardening-related films. Other topics include composting, bees, and the importance of hardening off your veggie starts. And as always, Glenn will answer.